Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. Trent Horn, our guest this hour. Trent is the author of many, many things, and the list keeps growing, but most recently of two books about the Catholic faith, one, Why We Are Catholic, published here at Catholic Answers Press, and the other, The Case for Catholicism, published by Ignatius Press. Open Forum means you can ask Trent any question you've got about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. You do not have to be Catholic to call. Hi, Trent. How are you?
I'm doing well, Si.
New Year progressing well?
Yes, I would say so. You know, you have a little break over Christmas and celebrating New Year's. Though once you have children, New Year's, especially small children, New Year's isn't that quite exciting of a holiday. You're like, oh, I made it to 10:30. It's the New Year somewhere.
Right.
I'm going to go to bed.
Yeah, we do that. I never understand Arizona time. You all are on a different clock than the rest of us, or you just don't change the time. So sometimes you're on, sometimes you're off. But we're 3 hours from New York. So they drop that ball at 9 o'clock. We're like, boom, Happy New Year. Night. See you tomorrow.
Right.
And it doesn't change when you get older. Well, I guess there's people our age who are more fun than we are, but my wife and I are dull.
No, you enjoy
no, we're dull.
You know, the more cozy aspects of marriage and, you know, ringing in the New Year in a nice private affair at a reasonable time.
All right. Okay, you put a really good spin on how dull we are.
I used to work, I should work part-time for a PR organization, so.
Yeah, that was real PR for my marriage. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Well, you know that we're giving your stuff away practically here for Pro-Life Month, or for, I guess, Respect Life Month is what the more common term, but we're giving away your book, Persuasive Pro-Life, for $5. Making the Case for Life, your DVD, for $5. Do they ask you before they do this, or they just – they're like, whatever?
I think it kind of comes with the territory, but I'm happy that they do it because these are resources I love getting out to people on a wide scale, and especially when we have Sanctity of Life Month, Respect Life Month. I think this is Sanctity of Life because I thought October was Respect Life.
Oh, very – okay. All right. I'll buy that.
I think. We'll find out here later, maybe. But obviously, pro-life issues, especially abortion, come up a lot this month because it's the anniversary of Roe versus Wade. And so people will be talking a lot about this, as they usually do. Later this month, I'm going to be speaking at the Students for Life Conference in Washington, D.C. to about 2,000 or 3,000 high school and college students, equipping them to go back to their university campuses and engage those who disagree with them on the issue of abortion. So it's very exciting. And for people who want to learn more about how to talk about this issue, that's why I wrote Persuasive Pro-Life, because it's the most in-depth pro-life apologetic book aimed at lay people out there easily. So yeah, visit our shop website. But yeah, I think you can get it right now, limited time, for about $5.
$5. That's it, right? 888-318-7884 is our number. It just so happens my wife is watching us on Facebook right now. She just typed in, I'm not dull. But I believe if you're watching Facebook in the middle of the day, by definition, you are. Well, sorry. I'm not gonna we got lots of calls.
Trent, how's that shoe tasting?
I'm going to be in trouble when I get home. Catherine in Maine listening on our good friends there at the Presence Radio Network. Catherine, you are on with Trent Horn. Your question, please.
Hi. I'm calling about a question and an encounter I had at a hospital recently. I'm a Eucharistic minister, and a young lady was quite upset. Came towards me and asked if I had a Bible and also if I knew how to do an exorcism. So we got her a Bible, and I said, I don't know how to do an exorcism, but I said, I will go up with you. So I went up to the hospital room. She said her boyfriend, who has had all these medical tests, they all came out negative, but he had been playing with a Ouija board, and then things started to act. He started to act very in a peculiar way, with strange voices and being aggressive and things like that. So Fortunately, a priest was walking by, the chaplain, and he was in there, and we got a lot of sacramentals for him, miraculous medals, rosary beads. I gave her a little Catholic prayer book that she meditate on the Stations of the Cross and just keep thinking about Jesus, but I didn't really know what to do, I guess, to believe it or not. I didn't want to reinforce the wrong things. It's right. Kind of complicated, I guess, but is that pretty much all that I would have been able to do, is just kind of be there and be quiet? I also felt I should be kind of quiet because I didn't want to stir up anything one way or the other.
Sure. Well, what I would say, first of all, it's always appropriate to pray for people who are sick, and if they appear to be the victims of a spiritual attack or even a demonic possession, there's nothing wrong with praying for that person and asking for the Lord to send the Holy Spirit to heal them and to bind, you know, any spirits that may be attacking them, to bind in the name of Jesus, to depart from this person. We should always pray for anyone, and we don't necessarily have to assume what they're suffering from. If we see someone's in a hospital and they're suffering from some kind of illness, maybe it's physical, maybe it's psychological, maybe it's spiritual, we may not be able to determine that, but we can always pray for their well-being. There's nothing wrong with that. However, performing the rite of exorcism is something that should be left to those who have been granted permission by the church to do that, which are typically priests, though I do have relatives who are lay people that are involved in exorcism ministries. So there are lay people who are involved in this, but typically it is priests who are granted this faculty of permission to perform this particular rite. Actually, a few years ago, the church just translated from Latin into English a new rite of exorcism. So if you suspect that someone is the victim of demonic possession, you should probably contact a priest that you know, or you could contact the diocese that you're in and ask if there is an exorcism healing ministry, one with priests and lay people involved. If they have one, or there may be a nearby one they can refer you to, because it requires a certain amount of experience to be able to determine if someone is the victim of demonic possession or if they're suffering from an unrelated psychological malady or mental illness. So it takes experience to be able to determine that, and experience to also know how to properly respond to that, because, you know, when you're dealing with demons, you're playing with fire, you know, no pun intended. Well, pun intended. So that would be my advice for you, Catherine. Is that helpful for a path forward if you're dealing with this in the future?
Yes, it definitely is. I just felt like I kind of left her out in the cold, and she wasn't there the following week. So I think it would have been good if I could have given her a number to call the diocese, and they could have been a good resource for her.
Yeah, or if you run into her again, you can always go and contact the diocese yourself and ask about just ask for exorcism healing ministries or any priests in the diocese who have experience with exorcism, and then you can bring that information to her. But I think it's better to not wade into something that you are not familiar with or not properly equipped to handle. It's better to refrain than to jump into something and get in over your head, especially if you're dealing with something as serious as demonic possession. So, yeah, hopefully you can get that information. And then if you see her again, share that with her. And for our listeners, we have some resources on exorcism on our website. I think Patrick Coffin conducted an interview with an exorcist you can read on our website. And we have a little 20 answers booklet, Angels and Demons, that probably handles some of that as well. So thank you very much for calling.
Thank you, Catherine. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live with Trent Horn right after this.
Don't you just love listening to Trent Horn? Did you know you can book Trent or any of our other great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 a copy. That's a savings of over 70%. This DVD was made specifically with you in mind. to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue, and to give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds, so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copy of the DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5 a copy, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed a list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Come on, Nick. I just feel like you're being mean to me, Nick. Nick, you're just being mean to me. It's Thursday. You haven't played the Groovy Thursday open forum music yet. It's like break after break after break. I still don't get my groovy music. I know you're going to play it one of these times. Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Trent Horn, the author of Why We're Catholic and The Case for Catholicism, among many other things, and a well-known and well-respected speaker on the Catholic faith and on respecting the sanctity of human life. 888-318-7884 is our number, 888-31-TRUTH. We go now to Matthew in Alexandria, Virginia, watching on YouTube. Thanks for joining us on YouTube, Matthew. Your question for Trent.
Hello, guys. Nice to talk to you. My wife and I have really benefited from your guys' show. It's been great. I appreciate what you do.
Thank you.
I wanted to see if you guys can kind of get a little bit of clarity for me. I'm a kind of a student of history, and I've been doing a lot of study on Islam, and so I wanted to kind of get a grasp on where the Catholic Church is, because right now we're an RCIA. We've just become, I guess we're going to become Catholic this Easter, and I'm trying to come to grips with, when I'm reading the Catechism, it says that that Islam serves or worships the same God. They have the same Abrahamic faith. But when I look at the history of Islam, I just don't see it. Their attributes of God are different. And now I'm talking about Muslims, because, you know, I was a Protestant for many years, and now I look back and say, when I was a product of where I was, what I was raised in. So of course I'm going to believe those things. So it's not about Muslims, but it's about Islam itself. I mean, what is the Catholic understanding of Islam and its position with Catholicism, and how are we supposed to see this? Because, you know, 550 battles, taking over two-thirds of Christendom and half of Italy, all of Spain, I mean, all the way up to Vignette. That stuff really weighs on you when you look at history. So I wanted to kind of get yours for a second, because I really respect you guys. We listen to you every night. So I wanted to see what you guys have to say about it.
Sure. And I think a good place to go would be in the Catechism of the Catholic Church in paragraph 841. Speaks about Islam within the plan of salvation, that as God has a plan of salvation, he understands that other religions will form over time. But because God is omniscient and all powerful, he can help guide people to at least some aspects of the truth, even if they find themselves in a false religion. So there are things that are true in other non-Catholic or non-Christian religions. So just because they're not the one true faith, it doesn't mean they're 100% in error. We can find some common ground with different faiths. For example, with Protestants, we have a lot of common ground because we believe in the divinity of Christ, the Trinity. We believe in salvation by grace. With Jews, we have common ground in the Old Testament. We believe in one God, and we hold everything that was revealed in the Old Testament. So what does the Catechism say about Islam, and what kind of common ground can we find there? This is what it says. The plan of salvation also includes those who acknowledge the Creator, in the first place amongst whom are the Muslims. These profess to hold the faith of Abraham, and together with us they adore the one merciful God, mankind's judge on the last day. So it's important to understand what this is saying. We should tease out what it is not saying. I noticed that you said in your question, you said that the church teaches that Islam belongs to the Old Testament also, or has a relationship there. If you notice in this part of the catechism, it says of Muslims, these profess to hold the faith of Abraham. So when you read the Quran and you see how it describes the Old Testament, it actually does get a lot of it wrong and slants it towards its theological opinion. They claim to be the offspring of Abraham, but they're not connected to the covenantal promises of the Old Testament like Jewish people are. So they profess to hold the faith of Abraham, but are not direct descendants of that faith like our Jewish brothers and sisters are. Second, this is not saying that the God of Islam or Allah is the exact same as the God of Christianity. All it is saying is that Christians and Muslims have something in common in that we are monotheists. We both agree there is one infinite God, and this God is holy or good and will judge the sins of mankind on the last day. So there is one God, he is infinite, he's of a moral nature, and he will judge sin. That's something Christians and Muslims have in common. But after that, we do have much more that we do not have in common, because Muslims deny the Trinity, for example. So is that helpful to understand what we have in common, but also what we don't have in common?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of bothered when I would try to look at the attributes they had for Allah and the attributes we have for God, and they were completely diametrically opposed. So it does help to understand that they are professing to be part of the Abrahamic line, and they're professing to serve the same God. So we're looking at it as more of a connection so that we can evangelize.
I do want to stress, though, that there are things we do completely agree on. We do both agree there is only one God. Muslims are fierce, fierce monotheists. That's why they have so much trouble with the Trinity. So we do have something in common there. For example, we agree that there is one God. They also agree that the Old Testament and the New Testament represent divine revelation. The Quran, in several places, tells people, Allah sent the Torah, he sent the gospel, and you should believe Jesus, you should believe the gospel. What happens today is that Muslims will say that the New Testament, the text of the New Testament, has been corrupted. So the parts of the Bible that say, for example, that Jesus is God, or that we should worship Jesus, not merely as a prophet, but as God who rose from the dead, they say, well, those parts are corrupted, there's textual corruptions, and that simply actually isn't the case when you look at textual criticism and how the New Testament has been preserved for the past 2,000 years. I cover that a little bit in my book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Bible Difficulties. I have an appendix that deals with claims that both atheists and Muslims make that say we can't trust the Bible, and we most assuredly can. So hopefully that's a good start for you, and I'd also recommend just searching for Islam on our website, Catholic.com. We have a lot of good resources and articles about that as well.
Thank you, Matthew, for that call. I hope that was helpful. We go now to George in Los Angeles, California. George, you are on with Trent Horn. Your question, please.
Hi, Trent.
Hello,
I have
George.
A question. A family member of mine was on YouTube, I guess, and they're watching a documentary. I don't know. They said it was from PBS, Arab perspective on the Crusades, and I was a bit of it myself. I got the impression that they were kind of bashing Europe at that time, that it was very poor, backwards. But he tells me that the documentary mentions of a Muslim diplomat who's visiting Europe, and he purports seeing Catholics using prayer as a form of torture. And, I haven't gotten that part yet. I'm just wondering if that's possibly true or not.
Well, number one, I'm skeptical of hearing this. I've never heard of this claim. One, about a Muslim diplomat who goes to Europe. So I'm wondering here, what does he mean prayer is being used as torture? I assume it would be prayers being used for prisoners who are tortured, but most of these prisoners would have been in the eastern part of the empire or in the Middle East. They wouldn't have been in the middle of Europe. And number two, what do they mean that prayer is being used as a form of torture? I mean, compared to most kinds of medieval torture that were present, that we have to remember, of course, that torture was common. It's been common throughout human history to use to extract confessions or to punish people. And that actually during the Middle Ages, people who were convicted by the Inquisition of undermining the authority of the state or the church, they often wanted to be tried in ecclesial courts instead of state courts, because the state courts were very harsh in their use of torture, and the church was renowned for not being as harsh in that same way. So, you know, when you think about medieval torture, if I could just sit and have somebody praying to me a bunch, I would way pick that over something like the rack. So, yeah, I think that this sounds like a kind of urban legend being peddled. And when it comes to the Crusades, a lot of modern historical studies of this, especially popular studies you see in documentaries, are just usually very distorted and biased against the Catholic faith and against Europe, painting Islam as kind of, you know, this peaceful religion who's being attacked by Western imperialists. And when that's not the case, what happened were that Christians have been dwelling in the Holy Land for centuries, and it was Muslim conquerors that took over this area, subjugated them, killed them, or required them to pay onerous taxes and not practice their faith as they would like. And then Christians reacted to the call from people like, I think it was Pope Urban II, who gave them the call to go and rescue the Holy Land from these conquerors. So I would recommend for you, George, that if you see this documentary and you hear stuff in it like, wait, that doesn't sound right, you should get a book. And the book is The Glory of the Crusades by my friend Steve Weidenkopf. It's published by Catholic Answers Press. Awesome book, Glory of the Crusades. Thomas Madden is also another good academic source on Crusade history to cut through these myths. So is that helpful?
I have one last question,
sure,
if you don't mind. Yeah, sure. So he also mentioned from the same documentary, like I said, I'm watching it myself, but he mentions that the documentary purports that the Islam conquest of Europe brought multiculturalism, and that the Islamic Empire brought multiculturalism because they didn't require Christians to convert. And I don't know. Is that also a myth, I guess?
Yeah, that's also a myth as well. You can only in the most strained sense of the word could you say they did not require people to convert. Usually they did, but in some cases a person was allowed to retain their religion, but they were treated as a second-class citizen. They had to pay onerous taxes. They certainly couldn't proselytize their faith. I mean, even today in many Muslim countries, proselytizing or sharing the Christian faith is punishable by death. So, yeah, that's also, once again, there's going to be lots and lots of myths. That's why Steve Weidenkopf was able to put together a whole book on that, The Glory of the Crusades, which I'd recommend for you to check out to kind of cut through these all the myths you're going to come across on this subject. So thank you very much for calling in.
Thanks, George. We'll go now to Greg in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. And Greg, we may have to do one of those. Give us the question, and we'll give you the answer after the break. Things, we'll see how we do on time. Your question for Trent Horn.
Okay, thank you. A couple different scenarios, one question. Basically, a family member who is married in the Catholic Church gets divorced, wants to remarry, obviously without an annulment, and would be outside the church. And another family member possibly thinking of a same-sex so-called marriage. What is my moral obligation, I guess, do I attend the service? Do I not attend the service? If by attending the service, am I somehow endorsing my support? As a Catholic, what do I do in that situation?
Okay, so, Greg, your question is, what do I do when it comes to attending I've been asked to attend a same-sex wedding, and then did you say there was another wedding, another situation, or just the same-sex wedding?
Well, that one, and yeah, the other situation was, you know, if a family member who was married in the Catholic Church got divorced, did not get an annulment, and mm-hmm. wants to get remarried, with
right.
the idea that, well, being remarried is essentially adultery.
Yes, right. Well, here's what I would say. The church does not have an explicit teaching on what weddings a person can or cannot attend. However, it does teach that we have a duty to not cause scandal. And scandal occurs when we partake in an activity and make others think that it is moral what is taking place there, and we lead them into sin or thinking something is good when it's actually wrong. When it comes to a same-sex wedding, I think it's very cut and dry that a Catholic could not attend a same-sex wedding because this technically isn't even a wedding. This is not marriage, because marriage is the union of a man and woman. This is it's a fraudulent replacement of marriage. It takes marriage, the union of men and women, the conjugal act that unites a man and woman, and replaces it with just adult relationships. That's not what marriage is. So that would always cause scandal for a Catholic to appear at. Now, could there be cases where you have a man and woman getting married and there's a certain impediment? Possibly, possibly not. That might be something we'll have to discuss more when we come back from the break.
We will do that when we come back right after this. Trent Horn is our guest. Hang on, Greg. We'll get to the second half of that question when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Glad you're with us. Join us on air with your questions today on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about my new book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties. Have you ever read something in the Bible that confused you? Or has a skeptic ever asked you to explain a scandalous passage and you didn't know what to say? Doesn't Genesis contradict science? Why does the Bible promote slavery? How could God order his people to kill women and children? It's happened to just about everyone. But now you have a place to turn for the answers. In Hard Sayings, I look at dozens of the most confounding passages in Scripture and offer clear, reasonable, and Catholic keys to unlocking their true meaning. After reading this book, you'll be equipped to answer the toughest questions skeptics ask about the Bible. So don't be left without an answer again. Order your copy of Hard Sayings today by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Looking for the best in solid Catholic resources that can answer your questions on all things Catholic? Looking for books, audio, and DVDs by the top Catholic thinkers and speakers on the planet today? Stop in today and visit the shop at Catholic.com. All of our resources are time-tested, apologist-vetted, and trustworthy and faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church. There's truly no better source for solid Catholic resources anywhere on the Internet. And now, we've made your online shopping even more affordable with $5 flat rate shipping within the continental U.S. When you're shopping for great Catholic books, CDs, DVDs, and more, turn to someone you can trust. Visit the shop at Catholic.com today. That's shop.catholic.com.
The Trump administration rolls back the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate.
U.S. bishops calling for the total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Pope Francis offers prayers for the victims of the California wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
Your link to news headlines Catholics count on at the top of the hour. Weekdays on EWTN Radio.
Searching the heart for spaces, clear the doors.
Nick, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me, Nick?
I think that's Throwback Thursday.
Throwback Thursday, is that
we're throwing back about 15 centuries, yeah. 10 centuries.
Okay, thank you, Gregory the Great, for that music. But I was looking forward to the groovy music, and you didn't play the groovy music. It's just mean, Nick. You're a mean person. It is open forum. It is Thursday. Trent Horn is our guest, and we should be playing the groovy Thursday open forum music, but we're not. 888-318-7884 is our number. When we went to the break, you were talking with Greg a little bit about attending weddings in various situations. You wanted to continue with that trend.
Yeah, so he gave two examples. One would be a same-sex wedding, two men or two women. The other would be a wedding between with a Catholic who's divorced, has not sought an annulment, and is getting remarried. I would assume outside of the church, because this wouldn't be allowed in the church if you'd been previously married. And what I said, the answer to that is the church has no specific teaching on attending weddings, but it does say we ought not cause scandal. And I think, one, anyone who attends a same-sex wedding, this is scandalous because that's not even marriage that's taking place. This is an opportunity to scandalize anyone who sees a Catholic at something like this. Now, however, the case of someone who's been previously married and didn't get an annulment and getting remarried, it's much more common, something that happens in many of our families. And it's a situation that, unlike the other one, there's a possibility it could be regularized if the parties involved obtained an annulment and had their marriage convalidated. Now, you still have to judge it. You could still be causing scandal by making people think that this is all right. So you have to judge that because you might also have counterbalancing reasons for going. For example, if you're a close family member or friend to the people getting married, you might want to maintain that relationship because it will allow you in the future to help them obtain an annulment, convalidate their marriage, or maybe to help them come back to the faith and live as brother and sister if an annulment is not possible. So that's one where you could try to, there may be a compelling interest in attending that outweighs the possible harm of scandal, but you would just have to discern for yourself and follow your conscience on that matter as to whether it is scandalous or not for you to attend. I think at Catholic Answers in general, our recommendation is not to attend weddings like this, but ultimately it would be your conscience to decide. But I think it's very, very clear in the case of a same-sex wedding, one cannot attend. That's definitely scandal. Others, it may not be as clear, but you'd have to make sure to follow your conscience in that regard. So Greg, is that helpful?
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. I guess what I wrestle with is, like you said, doing what is morally right and not causing scandal. And then the other side is the relationship with these people and, causing harm or, wanting to maintain the relationship as a means of, maybe, I don't know, maybe someday that they will decide to, their hearts change and they decide,
right,
to look into the Catholic Church or something like that.
Right. And that's a valid way of viewing this when these situations come up, and they're very common. So I'd recommend for you and other listeners, we have a good article on our website. I believe my former colleague Jim Blackburn wrote it. It's called Should I Attend the Wedding or Not? And it talks about weddings and marriage validity and the scandal involved when it comes to attending irregular weddings. Mostly it focuses on situations like the latter, where you have someone who is divorced, previously married, and does not have an annulment. So definitely check that out on our website, and thank you for calling.
We go now to Jared in Alabama, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Jared, you are on with Trent Horn. Your question, please.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can.
Okay. My question was, I was asking about music in the church. Where I live, I encounter a lot of Church of Christs, and a lot of the claim that they usually like to make is that instruments in church, are not, talked about in the New Testament. It's silent on that, therefore you shouldn't do it. And I also read somewhere, I don't remember where I read this, but apparently music and, harmony was banned in the early church because it was, playing with people's emotions too much. So could you maybe, flesh that out for me a little bit and how would you respond to that?
Yeah, first, I would say I'm not familiar with any particular bans on either singing or playing musical instruments in the early church. It's possible that there were some churches or regions that prohibited the use of music because it may have been a cause for scandal, or it may have been something that was too similar to what was happening in pagan temples, for example, though I'm not familiar with any kinds of bans like that in the early church. As for the Church of Christ argument that the Bible doesn't speak about using musical instruments in church, the problem with this argument, number one, of course, is that it's relying on the assumption of sola scriptura, that everything we believe as Christians must be explicitly found in Scripture. Because if you believe that, there's actually a whole lot of other things that you wouldn't be able to do in church either. For example, the New Testament never describes anyone getting married in a church. It doesn't describe people really meeting in churches. A lot of the early believers who were Jews met in synagogues for prayer. Now, it says they may have gathered together in homes, for example, but getting together in large churches was a later phenomena than what we see in New Testament times. So if you restrict your worship to only what you explicitly find in the New Testament, there's a lot of things we take for granted that many Protestants say are fine that are not actually described in the New Testament. Finally, what I would say is that since Jesus gave authority to the church has authority to decide its discipline and practices. Jesus did not, well, one, he never actually told, prior to his ascension into heaven, he never told anyone to write anything down, and he never gave anyone any writings. He didn't give us a giant manual saying, do this, do that, if this happens, do that. Because that's not practical. He gave us a church with his authority and a church that would have successors that would inherit that authority, inherit the word of God, written and unwritten in sacred tradition, and use that to help understand how the church should live out the faith that was deposited once and for all to the saints, as Jude 3 says. So the church changes disciplines or traditions with a lowercase t, such as the kinds of vestments that are worn, church decor, art, music, singing, in order to reach people where they're at in their different cultures. But if the church has the authority to bind and loose, as Jesus says it does in Matthew 18:18, then it's got to have that authority to be able to say this music's appropriate and this is not. And when you look at documents like Sacrosanctum Concilium from the Second Vatican Council, or the general instruction of the Roman Missal, all it says about music is that music is acceptable in church. I think it says the organ has a place of high esteem, but other instruments are acceptable if they can be played in a way that the sacredness of the church is maintained. So is that a helpful understanding of that?
Yeah, definitely. So you said about the early church, there was, maybe it was in some, you know, isolated parts, but it was never like, I guess it was never an official thing for all of the church to obey.
I'm just saying I'm not familiar with there being a universal ban on the use of instruments in churches for early worship. So it's nothing that I'm familiar with, but all I'm saying is that even if there were bans like this in certain regions or in certain places, the church has the ability to prescribe worship, proscribe, forbid, and prescribe, say this is how it should be done, because the church, Christ has given the keys of the kingdom to Peter and to his successors and really to the apostles as a whole. And so having the authority of Christ, the church is able to issue disciplines and rules to help people conduct worship and liturgy in a proper way to grow closer to Christ. So if you'd like more about that, I think good resources in some of this would probably be, I think Mike Aquilina has a book, the Apostles and the Church Fathers and Their Times, which may touch on some of these issues. Otherwise, I would just check out our website, Catholic.com, for more information. But thank you for calling.
Thank you, Jared, for that call. We go now to Luisa in Illinois, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Luisa, your question for Trent Horn.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Awesome. I am a huge fan. I'm super excited to be talking to you, especially of your pro-life work.
Thank you.
And that's been super helpful to me. But my question today is about dances. So I am a senior in high school, and I'm always really interested about learning new things about my faith. And I go to a Catholic high school. So I watched this one YouTuber, and he is a very conservative Catholic. And he usually has some very good things to say, but recently I watched a video of his where he was talking about dances, specifically situations like a high school dance. And he mentioned that even at a Catholic high school, even if there's not something that would be considered like a mortal sin, when somebody is dancing, it's still not a good idea to go. And he quoted St. Francis de Sales saying that no Catholic should go to any organized dance at all.
Right. Okay. Yeah, this is interesting. This reminds me of a small town in the Midwest that actually banned dancing outright and didn't change their ways until Kevin Bacon gave this really big speech. Are you familiar with that at all?
You're referring to the older version of that. There's a newer version without Kevin
Bacon. Yeah, so Luis, I'm referencing the movie Footloose, if you haven't seen it. That's what that reminds me of. Great movie, by the way. Well, here's what I would say. Number one, the church has no specific teaching saying that dancing, even co-ed dancing among young people, is wrong. I mean, anyone who would say that dancing in general is just always wrong, I don't see any evidence for that. In paragraph 1674, the Catechism talks about various forms of piety surrounding the church's sacramental life, like stations of the cross, processions, and it says religious dances. So dancing is just movement of the body. It's a kind of art, and it's a kind of celebratory art. The Old Testament talks about how David danced before the ark, which was also mentioned in Footloose. That was in Kevin Bacon's speech in the movie. Now, it seems to me what this YouTuber is concerned about is he quotes St. Francis de Sales, and I've also heard a similar quotation related to a regional council of Baltimore in the United States talking about how Catholics should not attend particular dances. But in the context, it appears that what's being prohibited are places that are notorious for lewd or crude behavior taking place. These include things like masked balls, you know, where people go and wear masks to engage in dance and they don't know who the other people are, and people wander off and, you know, do things that are not appropriate with one another. But even today, there are high school dances that are not appropriate. I mean, I remember when I went to high school, which was a fairly long time ago, in contrast to what some people may think. But even in high school dances now, you know, you'll see people grinding. They're not even dancing. They're just simulating sex acts. And it's gross, really. That obviously would be, if there's, that is happening a bunch at a dance, yeah, I think that's something scandalous that you shouldn't attend. But if it's something I've been to, I mean, I was invited the first prom I went to. I was invited, this girl went to a really small Catholic school. They only had like 15 high schoolers. So everyone in the school had to invite someone that didn't go to the school. And so I was she invited me, and there were like 30 of us and like 30 of us and like 15 chaperones. And we were all just dancing, you know, at this restaurant that was rented out, and in a very clean and fun way. So as long as people are respecting one another, not leading people into sin, not dressing inappropriately, not simulating sexual acts when they're dancing, I think it can be very appropriate. That's why I think it's great for young people to learn clean forms of dancing, like swing dancing, for example, or ballroom dancing. For the young men who are listening, you should learn to dance. It's a forgotten art that people should know. So is that a helpful reply on that question?
Yes, that is wonderful. Thank you so much. So I can go to my prom without worrying about it.
Sure. Hey, make sure everybody's respecting one another. Just dress appropriately. And remember, it's about dancing, having fun, but not leading people into kinds of temptations.
Have you seen that movie Footloose, Luisa?
I actually haven't. I don't watch a lot of movies, though.
So you knew the answer. You knew that Kevin Bacon had given this answer years ago.
So, I think that should be fine. But when in doubt, you know, talk to your parents, the chaperones, and maybe your priest or youth minister. And I think things should be fine. Honestly, when it comes to high school proms, I'm more concerned about what happens after prom. So I would recommend, if you go to prom or others go to prom, go to a place that is also chaperoned with parents who are morally responsible to make sure everyone's behaving, having a good time, and doesn't do anything they'll regret. So keep that in mind, and thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for that call, Luisa. I think, Trent, and all joking aside, I think we're going to do some dancing at the next Catholic Answers Conference.
Yes, I saw that this
Jimmy's going to call some square dancing there. So
yes, I forgot. So there's swing dancing, ballroom dancing. Square dancing is a wonderful, vigorous, fun, morally appropriate way to enjoy dance. I've had the pleasure of being at dances that Jimmy has called on multiple occasions. So if you would like to come also for our great talks on faith and science, but hopefully it comes through and you could have some square dancing with Jimmy Akin, check out the website CatholicAnswersConference.com, CatholicAnswersConference.com, to learn more.
Got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Trent Horn is coming right back.
January is pro-life month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and his DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 each. That's a savings of over 70%. Both the book and the DVD were made specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue, and to give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of the book, Persuasive Pro-Life, or the DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5 each, just call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clearer witness to the gospel. St. Paul Street Evangelization's online school of evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
It could be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows you how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never really seemed to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
There it is, the Groovy Thursday Open Forum music. Thanks, Nick. We can be friends again because you finally got around. 2 hours we've been at this almost, and you finally got around to playing the groovy music. Trent Horn is our guest. Open Forum means any question that you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, we will do our very best to get you a helpful and maybe even convincing answer. 888-318-7884 is the number if you would like to talk with Trent. And we go now to Sergio in McAllen, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Sergio, you are on with Trent Horn.
Yes, good evening. I'm glad that the groovy music came on because I was like hearing it also.
I know. Thank you, Sergio. That's what I needed, some support. As a matter of fact, we need more callers to support the groovy music.
Thank you. My question is not much. I'm the youth minister at my church, and my wife and I, we teach catechism to kids and adults. I just wanted to ask, what book would Trent recommend, like on the church fathers? Because for the adults, we use the Bible and the catechism, but something to help them with history to understand. Because, you know, many of them have questions about because they have friends that are, you know, Protestant or Baptist, but what would they recommend from the church fathers to show them the connection that the church has been Catholic since the beginning?
Sure. There's a lot of different resources I'd recommend on this subject. One that Catholic Answers puts forward is a book called The Fathers Know Best, Your Essential Guide to the Teachings of the Early Church by my friend Jimmy Akin. He was actually on the previous hour, and that's a really good reference, and it's ordered by topic. So you can look up, you know, what do the church fathers believe about purgatory? What do they believe about Mary, about the Mass, about the Trinity? So it's great that you can look that up. And at the beginning of the book, what's really cool is that it goes over, you know, who these church fathers were, where they lived, when they lived, the circumstances they lived in, and how they're related to the apostles and the beginning of our faith. So we had people like the apostolic fathers. These are people who had a close connection to the apostles, like Clement of Rome, for example, or St. Polycarp, St. Ignatius of Antioch. And then others who were the descendants of their writings later on. So that would probably be my first recommendation, would be The Fathers Know Best by Jimmy Akin. Also, Pope Benedict XVI wrote a great book on the fathers. So I think it's just called The Fathers of the Church. It's Clement of Rome until St. Augustine, that the fathers go beyond St. Augustine, but that's just the area that he focused on in that regard. And then another one that I would recommend, Rod Bennett has a great book called The Four Witnesses. And so that deals with four early apostolic and early church fathers that really talk a lot about the basics of our faith and how ancient something like the Mass is. And I think the four witnesses are Clement of Rome, Justin Martyr, St. Ignatius of Antioch, and St. Irenaeus. Were the ones that are discussed in that book. At least they were four early fathers. So those are some I would recommend there. And definitely keep your eye out. A lot of the work on the church fathers are written by Catholics. There are some that are written by Protestants. The largest collection of the church fathers, I think, available in the public domain is the Philip Schaff collection. The Philip Schaff collection is like 38 volumes. And it's a good resource if you want just like the really total writings. But it's unfortunate. Philip Schaff was very anti-Catholic in his writings in the 19th century. So there is a little bit of an anti-Catholic bias in how he writes about the fathers. But I would start with Jimmy Akin's book, then Rod Bennett, Pope Benedict XVI book. And Mike Aquilina, I think, has a book on the fathers as well. So that should get you going for a while, I think.
Okay, Sergio? Yeah,
thank you very much. Yes, and I bought a Trent's book, The Five Were Catholic and Hard Saints. It's a very good read. I've been buying a lot. I did my Christmas shopping from you guys using the winter.
The winter sale. Yeah, right. Sergio, all right. You say all the right things. You should call all the time, Sergio. I think maybe you should be a regular Thursday caller, especially when Trent's on. I just want to mention, you know, Trent, you gave all those resources. And I don't mention this enough, but Nick actually works really hard. And one of the things he does is he writes down all those resources. And then on the show page, because for each show, if you go to Catholic.com, there's a show page for that show. He'll list all the resources that you just mentioned. So if someone's ever listening to Catholic Answers Live and they hear Jimmy or Tim or Trent or Carlo or anybody mention a book or an article or a website, Nick will write it down and it'll be there on the website for you the next day when Nick posts the show. Sergio, thanks again for that call. Let's go to Sam in Vancouver, British Columbia, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Sam, your question.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thank you.
Okay, so I'm a Iraqi Catholic Chaldean living in Vancouver, BC, and I was born Catholic, but then my twin brother and my older brother converted to Protestantism. So they claim to be their evangelical. So I was having a conversation with them about how Mary was immaculately conceived and she has no original sin. And so I went to YouTube and I showed them Tim Staple with the host Marco on YouTube, how Tim talks about Mary without original immaculate conception.
So, Sam, I just got to get to only because we're running right up against the clock. Is that what you would like Trent to address, whether Mary was conceived without sin?
Yes, that's, but biblically, please.
Biblically, okay. Any comments there on Mary's conception without sin, Trent?
Sure. I would say that this is the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, that you know we are freed from original sin through baptism. God chose for Mary to be conceived without original sin and to be protected from sin. It was fitting for her so that she could be a suitable mother for the Mother of God, that God became incarnate through her, received flesh from her, and that flesh wasn't sinful. It wasn't necessary, but it was something fitting and glorious for God to do. And this is something that we know from sacred tradition, what the Church has given us in sacred writings, church fathers in the 4th century, like Ephraim the Syrian, that talk about Mary being without stain, being without sin. And then later, as the Church came to understand original sin, seeing how Mary was preserved from that as well. When it comes to Scripture, I would say that there is a reference to this dogma, or at least it's reflected in Scripture in Luke 1:28, when the angel says, "Hail Mary, full of grace." That particular Greek word, and in the context it's used in that address, the whole context, I believe that points to that Mary was full of grace as a particular characteristic of her being, something that she had throughout her whole life. I'm not saying that verse proves that that dogma, but I believe it is reflected and we can see it in there when we understand this dogma and how we've received it from sacred tradition. If you'd like to learn more, check out our website, catholic.com. And in my new book, The Case for Catholicism, I have half of a chapter that deals with the Immaculate Conception.
Thanks very much for that call. Thanks for all the calls today. And Trent Horn, thank you very much for spending that hour of open forum with us.
Of course. Happy to do so.
Tomorrow, the Bible Blueprint for the Church with Carlo Broussard and Matt Frad will be here to talk about how to win an argument without losing a soul. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.